Welcome to my show. This is Dr. David Kent. This is my weekly show every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. Today I have a special guest on. I have two great guests on today. The first one is Liza Long. She is a well-known author who sprang into the national spotlight with her blog, I Am Adam Lanza's Mother, in December of 2012, following the tragic shooting at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. Let me tell you a little bit about Liza Long before I have her jump on. She regularly contributes to the Huffington Post and Psychology Today. She's authored the book, The Price of Silence, A Mom's Perspective on Mental Illness, which I've been reading. She's appeared in a TED Talk in 2013 in San Antonio. She's also appeared on The Today Show, Anderson Cooper 360, The Dr. Oz Show, a Nova documentary, and other shows as well. Liza has been a single working mother raising four children since 2008, but a mother longer than that. Her story became instantly public knowledge after she had a famous blog in December of 2012. For better or worse, she's had to face intense public scrutiny and ridicule at times for her decision to speak out. And as she called it, she became an accidental advocate overnight. Ever since that fateful day, she's had to defend herself and be willing to come out publicly and discuss very difficult topics. And if she already didn't have enough on her plate, she's been raising a child that's been very misunderstood and struggling almost every part of his life, including school and home and the legal system and the medical system. And I got the feeling from just reading her book that she got very tapped out at times. It's hard to know where to begin our discussion today. There's so many layers and issues in her story. The book that she's written is The Price of Silence, and I'm struck by her sheer determination to help her son and try to find some way to earn a living and raise three other children, pay mounting medical bills that she's had along the way, and try to find peace and happiness for herself. So I don't know quite how she does it. But she's thrown her hat into the arena to talk about this publicly. So let me just welcome Liza onto the show, and I appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kent. It's such a privilege to be on the show. And I do have to clarify, fortunately, I am remarried as of 2014, so I don't have to go it quite alone anymore.
Congratulations on that. I couldn't tell from the book.
Yeah. Probably not at the time the book was published.
No, I don't think so. I knew there's new chapters to be written, so that's awesome.
Thank you.
So first of all, how are you holding up through all of the stuff you've been through with this?
You know, honestly, I'm very fortunate in many ways. At the time that my blog went viral, my family was absolutely in crisis. And I felt like I was the only mother in the world who was suffering in shame and silence, trying to raise a child who had an undiagnosed serious mental illness. So I shared our family story at that time. But since then, because I shared the story, one of the foremost experts in bipolar disorder in children, Dr. Dimitri Papalos, contacted me and said, I know what's wrong with Eric. I know what's wrong with your son. And he was right. My son was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in May of 2013, started taking lithium. And while it's not a happy ending diagnosis, as you know, it gave us a roadmap and a path that we could follow. And all kudos to Eric. He has really embraced that journey and taken responsibility for his own health care. He's doing amazingly well today. I think we both speak out and advocate because we want the type of ending, well, not ending, but the type of journey that our family's on to be a story for so many families who continue to suffer, who don't have access to care, who are still searching for answers.
Well, that's good to hear that there's some positivity coming out of this, because when this first came out, there's all kinds of opinions about whether you should have spoken out in the way you spoke out and how you wrote about it and what you said. But from my perspective as a psychiatrist, I think talking about these issues openly is a good idea. And the media can run with these things and have their own opinions and their own agendas, as we know. But at the end of the day, it's your story.
Right.
It's your own story.
Well, I mean, it's a complicated question. If you Google my name to this day, along with the phrase oversharenting, one of my favorite made-up words, I'm always Exhibit A for, you know, the bad mother who would talk in public about her child. I have to stress that, first, I blogged anonymously, like a lot of people who write about mental illness, for exactly the reasons you describe. And for me, I became an advocate when I decided to put my name on the story. That was a very difficult decision. My good friend Nathaniel Hoffman, who was then the editor for Boise State University's Blue Review, maybe one of five people in the world who knew I was behind my blog, which is the anarchist soccer mom, not the Antichrist soccer mom. I got that thrown at me
on
social media.
Right on that, I hope.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yes. Anarchist. And I'm not really an anarchist either. I live in Idaho, you know, it's what it is. But yeah, Nate told me, you know, until people put their names on these stories, it's not real. It's just this anonymous somebody out there. And in that moment, in that decision to put my name on the story, I really think that's when I became an advocate. I, however, did not use my son's real name. I used a pseudonym for him, Michael. I use his real name now because last year he decided to embrace his own identity and his own story. And I think these stories have multiple parts, and we do need to show respect for people and their parts of the story. But like you said, our family stories are very important. Often, people who live with serious mental illness especially are not able to speak up for themselves. And when in those cases, when they can't, family members have got to be the ones who are fighting. I've told people before, no one's going to fight for your kid like you are.
No, I totally get that and agree with that. And part of me, of course, relates to it. I have two sons with mental illness and had our own struggles. And my wife and I have struggled over the years. And so when I read your story and hear about it, I'm relating to it. Right. I'm understanding it.
Right.
And understanding the difficulty it is to speak out and talk about it. But partly why I have this show is to be able to talk about it and bring it out and say it's okay to talk about.
Well, right. We would never look at a mother who talked about her child's cancer and say, oh, you're a very bad mother. You shouldn't talk about that. That thing should be kept private. And you know, as a psychiatrist, that mental illness is physical illness. It's not all in your head, right? These
right.
are real illnesses with real symptoms and real challenges for the people who are living and striving to find their recovery, their best life possible. And mental illness really is a whole family illness, especially for family caregivers. I think it's complicated, and we need to address and not be afraid of those complications.
That brings up a point, too, as I was reading your book, and you talk about it in your book, but you know, you have three other children, and they are not having the same struggles as your other son.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in my family, we have five children. And so
right.
it's, you know, it's sort of the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And so, and that you can't avoid that. But at the same time, the other wheels don't always get the grease. And
right.
so it's can be hard on the rest of the family.
Right. I think the sibling experience deserves a lot more attention than it gets right now, especially within the literature. If you research the sibling experience, it's still kind of weak. You know, there are things like sib shops that Massachusetts has, for example, but we don't have that here in Idaho. And I remember that distinctly feeling that way. My oldest son is maybe on paper. Well, not just on paper, but you know, the kid everybody wants, right? So he was class president, spoke at his graduation. He's a concert pianist. He's majoring in math and physics, and you know, does all these amazing things. And I would literally go from National Honor Society or some kind of fancy meeting to juvenile detention center for my second son, who's equally amazing, you know. But because of the challenges of Eric's unique brain, my two children had very different paths. And I'll say all three of Eric's siblings are some of the most compassionate people I've ever met. Mental illness really can bring out love in all of the family members. So like when my older son went to college, there was an understanding that there wouldn't be a lot of money to go to college. A lot of that had gone to his brother's medical care. And he was fine with that. He was understanding about that.
It's easy to have resentment towards a sibling mm-hmm. who's getting the resources and the energy
sure.
and the emotion. And so it's a real challenge as a parent to try to figure out a way to make them feel just as important.
Right. I think that's one of the major challenges of parenting, but it takes a very collaborative approach and a very honest approach for the whole family. So we've not really hid Eric's struggles from the other children, even the younger two children. But I will say, because of the level of violence, which I haven't been afraid of talking about, I know I catch a lot of flack for that, but it was a part of my family's experience. And I don't fault Eric for that. It was his illness. But because of the level of violence, my younger two children grew up with a safety plan in place. And they see therapists themselves to this day to deal with some of the trauma
sure.
that will come from living in a home like that. So I don't think you can stick your head in the sand as a parent. You have to consider all of your children's safety, and you have to consider all of their needs.
Well, I really appreciate, you know, being a psychiatrist, that you've been willing to speak out. It's not easy to do that. It's challenging, but you're very articulate and you're a good voice for it. So I think it's really awesome that you're doing that.
Thank you. Some days I wish I could take it back, though.
No,
as any family would know.
I'm sure that's the case.
Yeah.
We're going to take a little break here. This is Dr. David Kent. This is my weekly show. To get more information, you can go to my website at treasurevalleytms.com. I post all of these shows on my website. So if you don't catch it or catch all of it, you can catch up to it on my website. Also, I have a Facebook I'm constantly posting on Facebook through Treasure Valley TMS.
Kent, welcome back to my show.
So we'll take a break. And
we'll be back.
I've got Liza Long on my show today. I'm very excited to have her on the show today. She's went into the national spotlight over a blog she wrote in 2012. She's written a book called The Price of Silence, which I've been reading, and I can't really lay it down. It's really well written. It's very authoritative. She really did her homework on that, so I have a lot of respect for her. And she's, you know, not in the field so much, but she's very articulate, and she's a writer by profession, I guess.
Yes.
So welcome back to the show. We've been talking about her son, Eric, who she refers to as Michael in her book. He's the one who struggled with mental illness all of his life. And fortuitously, as she came out to speak about this, then some good things happened to her. She found a psychiatrist who heard the story and popped up and said, you know, he thought he might be bipolar, and she started treating him for bipolar, and things have gotten better. It's not perfect, but things have gotten better with that treatment. So That's the good part of the story, and the struggles I think she wanted to let out there so other parents who are struggling with the same exact sort of things can hear that they're not alone. And I think that's the problem, is that a lot of parents feel alone. The system out there isn't real good at times. It's not necessarily warm and friendly and fuzzy. It's often very brutal to have our kids go through these systems where they get handcuffed and taken by the police to a emergency room or a hospital, or worse yet, they go into the legal system, and that's more often the case than not, is they get into a legal system. The legal system doesn't understand them very well. We have a pretty long history of jailing the mentally ill here in our state. We've tried to overturn that and reverse the stigma. Liza is the president of the local chapter of NAMI, which stands for the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, which is a difficult job and a rewarding job, too. It's a lot of volunteers, people who care about this and willing to take the time to do it. So tell us a little bit about your involvement with that.
I am such a big fan of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and especially our Boise chapter. As you mentioned, there's such a critical lack of resources. And the place that NAMI fills in our community is with support and education. So we have family support groups. We have peer support groups that meet regularly. You can check our website, www.namiboise.org. We also offer education classes, and we have signups going on right now on our website. So if you're interested in taking a family-to-family class to learn more about your loved one's illness, we have classes scheduled for fall, and also peer-to-peer classes. And we're really excited to have a new program here in Boise called the NAMI Basics class. I am a basics teacher, so that's my niche. And NAMI Basics is for parents of children who showed symptoms before the age of 13, so children like my son Eric. It's a really great program. I tell people I wish this is the class that I had taken when I did not know where to turn or what to do.
Well, that's awesome. You know, my wife and I actually took the family to family course. Even though I'm a psychiatrist and I know all about these illnesses and I treat it every day and I'm in the trenches all the time, It doesn't mean that my wife and I are on the same page. And not so much to her fault, but because we need to sit down together and go through a course and sort of discuss the topics that come up and discuss how we're going to approach our kids, not just the ones that have illness, but the ones who don't.
Right.
How do we want to be as parents? It's interesting to listen to other parents in the room, the stories that they go through. So this really isn't an isolated problem.
No, I think to me that's one of the most powerful things about both our classes and our support groups is you'll realize looking around the room that you are far from alone, that people you might not ordinarily think were going through the challenges you're facing, people who look just like you, are also in that room struggling, trying to find answers for their loved ones. And I find the model to be a very empowering one, both for peers, people living with mental illness, and for family members. One of the things I like about the National Alliance on Mental Illness is that it does include both groups. Actually, this isn't in my book, but I completed my doctorate in organizational leadership last year, and my dissertation research focused on communication styles and personality differences with peers and family members. As you may know, within the advocacy community, there's been something of a schism between the two groups. And what I like about NAMI is that it tries really hard as an organization to bring everybody into the room and consider everyone's needs.
Yeah, I think there were people in the room that were a little surprised that I was there.
Right.
But I said, well, I'm just a parent. I'm here as a parent.
And the parent experience is different from the professional experience, isn't it?
Well, you try to separate it if you can, because mm-hmm. you're right in the trees when you're the parent.
Right.
When you're the psychiatrist, you can be out of the trees a little bit and try to look objectively at the overall picture and do that. But when you're in the midst of it, you know, it's a different ball game.
Right.
And you don't think as clearly. So it's good to get in there and hear from other people. It was very informational, too. I was really impressed with the sort of the didactic part of it. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of good information. Because I'm a psychiatrist, I can look at it with a pretty critical eye. And I was impressed that it was very well done, it was research-based, and that they had a good medical foundation for what they were saying. So that part of it I was really pleased with.
I think having that medical information, too, can really, I don't want to say soothe parents, but at least make you feel like you understand better. You know, when the medical side of it is explained, again, it makes it like a physical illness for you. So many times, parents, we're all really good at blaming ourselves, right? Especially when our children suffer. I heard once that a mom is only as happy as her unhappiest child. And I think all of us moms, probably dads too, know what that feels like.
I think I know exactly how that feels, and my wife would concur with that, I think. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge, and you go through it, and sometimes you do think you're alone, even though I know statistically we're not alone, that the numbers are really pretty staggering, the number of people that suffer from mental illness, as you know. You've quoted those numbers in your book. Why don't you throw out some numbers for us?
Well, the National Alliance on Mental Illness Statistics will say that 1 in 5 adults in any given year will be living with a serious mental health condition. And for children, it's 1 in 5 before the age of 18 will have a serious and debilitating mental condition. I do spend a lot more of my time on what I call the 4%, which are the people living with serious mental illness, so schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and major depression. These illnesses are chronic and severe and life-impacting in a way that I think society often doesn't understand. We have a problem even with language in our society where we'll say, oh, that's so bipolar, or I'm feeling a little schizophrenic today, and I promise you, you're not. You know, and to make light of things like that, I think there still is very much a perception that because the symptoms are often behavioral, some of the symptoms are behavioral, people are making choices about those behaviors. And as you mentioned before, unfortunately, those choices often lead individuals with brain differences into the criminal justice system. We don't seem to have a better solution right now. Although, as a psychiatrist, you know, as well as I know, that there are multiple better options and solutions for our family members.
Yeah, there's always options. You know, sometimes they don't always feel like there's enough options, or there are limited options, and there are certainly a limit to all the options. But I always tell patients I always have a few tricks up my sleeve, and there's always something. And I always call every patient who comes to my office custom work.
I like that.
It's custom work. So it's not one size fits all.
Right.
So, you know, some respond to a certain medication or even a combination of medications. Some might fail medications, and now I'm using TMS now. So, and there's always ECT if needed. ECT is a little bit more difficult to pursue, but it's still available.
Right.
But TMS is such a great solution now that I feel so lucky these days that I have so many things to use.
Right.
To try to make it work for an individual.
I think that's the biggest thing to stress for family members and even for peers living with the illness, that, you know, just because the first medication or the first diagnosis doesn't work doesn't mean you should give up hope. By the time I wrote that blog post, I'll admit I had pretty much given up hope. I felt like we had been through multiple diagnoses, everything from autism spectrum to oppositional defiant disorder and intermittent explosive disorder. And these things sound really scary to a mom, by the way, although it's what we were seeing. We had an ADHD diagnosis at one point, like many families. When we finally came back and got the bipolar diagnosis, his previous diagnosis was something called PDD-NOS, which I joked to my son, oh, this means they have no idea what's wrong. You know, just throw some letters at you.
Bit of a garbage bag, garbage pail sort of diagnosis somewhat, but it has some meaning, but it's more descriptive than it really has some biological root.
Right. But our experience is so common, I think. That's what I want to stress. And so you, as a psychiatrist, seeing everyone as a custom model, that's the real key. And then for the patient to not give up, right?
Right.
To keep trying things until they find the right thing.
I tend to tell people if they come in my door and I see them, unless they don't come back in my door, I'm going to try everything in my power to figure out what's going to work for them and what isn't, and
right.
and be willing to be open to a new diagnosis if I need to. I might be barking up the wrong tree, so to speak.
Right. Well, and the other challenge, too, is even, I think, within the community, sometimes we might find something that works for us that may not work for someone else. And, you know, Eric's done really well with his diagnosis, with his treatment, but that may not be the right solution for someone else. And so, you know, to say, well, this worked for us, why isn't it working for you? We just need to pull back. We need to pull away from that judgment, you know.
It's what we call personalization. We personalize right. it. So it worked for us. It must work for everybody else.
Right.
Well, it's your experience, and it does work for you, and that is right.
Right.
And it does work for some people, but
sure.
it is so personalized in terms, or so individualized, the treatment,
right.
that's the thing we have to keep in mind.
I definitely experienced that as a mother. Like many people, I've had mental health diagnosis in my lifetime. I've been diagnosed with depression twice, once in college and once postpartum with my third child. And so I do have some understanding of how the mental health system works. But for me, you know, I was able to go into a doctor right away, 3 days into a psychiatrist. Who does that, right? So mm-hmm. within 3 days, I saw a psychiatrist. My first medication worked great. Within 4 months, I was able to wean off the medication. And, you know, hey, yoga works for me, you know?
Yeah.
So if that had been my whole experience, I might have looked at someone like my son and said, well, gosh, why don't you just go to yoga and snap out of it? But
that's
we're really,
really good
dealing
point.
With something
I hear that
else.
All the time. You know, people want to, they're well-meaning too. They want to help
sure.
people. They want to say what worked for them, and that's great. But my job is to be fairly objective and say what's going to work for this individual in front of me.
Right.
And that's really important. And the diagnosis is always critical to right. doing the right thing. Let's take a little break here. We'll be back in just a sec. We've got Liza Long on our show. She's doing a great job telling about her experience, and appreciate her being on the show today. This is David Kent. You can go to my website at treasurebyTMS.com. This is my weekly show every Sunday at 9 in the morning. Today I have Liza Long on the show. Is it Dr. Liza Long now that you got your doctorate?
I only make my kids call me Dr. Mom. Everyone else can just
okay.
call me Liza.
So she now has a doctorate, I understand. So
yeah.
she is well-educated. Very, very impressed with her credentials. She's been talking on my show today about her own personal experience with her son, with herself. She's been willing to share these sorts of experiences with the public, which I think is great. That's the purpose of this show, is to bring things to light, talk about them in the open, bring people that live here locally, and talk about their experiences. So the next question I have for Liza is, you know, in your book, which is very appropriate, and National Alliance for the Mentally Ill also focuses on this, is the idea of stigma. Can you tell me a little bit about stigma?
I would love to talk to you about stigma. Stigma, if people are listening to this and are not familiar with the term, this is a great chance for me to use my master's degree, which was in ancient Greek. And so the word comes from ancient Greek. And interestingly enough, stigma was a mark that was used to differentiate who slaves belonged to. That's how it was used in ancient Greek. So it was a visible mark. But the interesting thing about mental illness is that it's an invisible disability. It's an invisible difference. And so the stigma comes more from our ideas of what in our heads we've decided people with mental illness are like, rather than something we can view. And sociologists differentiate between two types of stigma. So there's visible stigma, which maybe like if I were in a wheelchair, you'd be able to see that I had a disability, or even something like skin color or gender. We can sometimes have visible stigma toward people. And then there's the invisible stigma. Now, interestingly, with visible stigma, society or other people may have ideas that are about the person, but the person does not internalize that stigma. In other words, you know, if I'm in a wheelchair, you may judge me, but I'm not going to judge myself for being in a wheelchair. With mental illness, with invisible stigma, it's different. And so the first place that stigma harms people with mental illness is the self-stigma, the feeling that, well, society thinks I'm a dangerous and unpredictable person, and so maybe I am. Maybe it's my fault. Maybe I should blame myself. Or if you're a parent, maybe it's my fault. Maybe it's my bad parenting. And unfortunately, there are plenty of people in society who are willing to agree with you if you practice self-stigma. Yes, it is your fault. You are a bad mom. You know, and as we internalize those messages, it becomes really hard to approach the medical problem, which can be solved, which, you know, people can be treated. Recovery is a thing, right? But stigma keeps us from moving on that journey toward recovery that all of us need. But the more I thought about that word stigma, the more I've decided really the word we should be using is discrimination. And the real problem isn't so much what other people think about mental illness, it's the practical effects of that. Where we really see discrimination is in the criminal justice system. So I'll give you a few more statistics that are frightening to me. On death row, more than 20% of people have serious mental illness and intellectual disability. So 20%, yet only 4% of the population. In our jails and prisons, 20% of the people who are incarcerated have serious mental illness, not depression, not ADHD, but bipolar, schizophrenia, major depression. That's 20%, but only 4% of the population. That's clearly discrimination. So something we're doing as a society is wrong. It's discriminatory. And I think we really need to stand up together, peers and family members, and fight this discrimination that's occurring in our society.
Well, I think that attitudes lead to behavior. Mm-hmm. So the attitude is, first of all, there's sort of a stigma. There's some sort of belief system in place that makes people think a certain way about other people. Mm-hmm. Then that belief system turns into behavior. And that's what discrimination is a type of behavior.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, if you did a study, for example, if you asked people in the general population if they would mind having a group home for adults living with autism built near their home, everyone's fine with that. That's fine. But if I say, what about adults living with schizophrenia? Not in my backyard. You are not building that in my backyard. And yet schizophrenia, as you know, schizophrenia and autism are like really similar in a lot of ways in terms of their behavioral symptoms, even in terms of how the brain is, what parts of the brain are impacted, the genetic makeup of those two illnesses. So why is our perception for one so different from our perception from the other? You know, and there are a lot of answers to that. Certainly the media has not been helpful. Certainly the focus on things like mass shootings has not been helpful when we talk about stigma.
No, I agree. I think that the media has not done us a favor necessarily. I always try to look at the raw data, look at the raw statistics. That really tells the whole story. Mm-hmm. People with serious mental illness in general are less violent than people without mental illness.
Especially when treated. Right.
But even untreated, there are the exceptions. Those exceptions are the ones that manage to find themselves in the media, spotlight. And so we get to see and hear about those things in every last detail.
Right.
So that changes our perception, which creates the stigma in some sense that we think that that's how it is for everybody who has these problems.
One of my friends, Ruth Johnson, put this very poignantly recently. Her son was violent, and she wrote an essay about his sentencing in Pennsylvania. And the first lines of this essay really stuck with me. She said, at 9 o'clock a.m., my son was a good schizophrenic. At 10 o'clock a.m., he was a bad schizophrenic. And the only thing that changed is he finally acted on year-long delusion and unfortunately killed his grandmother, my friend Ruth's mother. That was the only thing that changed between 9 and 10 o'clock. But at that point, then he became a criminal, and now he'll be incarcerated for 20 years.
Yeah, and those are difficult situations, and a lot of debate about that back and forth. And no one's here to say that people with mental illness can't commit a violent crime, and we know that they can. But we also know the general population does at a much higher rate per capita than the mentally ill. So we have to put it into perspective.
Well, and also, again, that people are more likely to be victims of violence when they live with serious mental illness than they are likely to be perpetrators of violence.
Right. People with mental illness are much more likely to be a victim.
Yes.
Which is what we see and I see on a regular basis in my practice. And I interview patients. I treat the seriously mentally ill every day. So I get to hear the stories. And I pretty much expect to hear some sort of abuse history.
Right.
Being bullied or being physically abused, emotionally abused, or even sexually abused. I mean, I almost expect to hear it.
We could do a whole different show on the effects of trauma and how that plays into all of these conditions.
Right. You know, we're talking about the brain, you know, in your book, and you pointed out, and in your TED talk, you pointed out, which I thought was really cool. I've talked a lot about it, is the brain is the most important organ we have, and yet we somehow relegate it to some lesser class.
Right.
When it really should be the first class, because it's the part of the body that controls everything else. It's the part where we think and we feel and we believe and we love and we hate, and all those things are centered in our brain. And so understanding it, accepting our human condition is important.
Right.
And sort of like you said, we get a cancer of the thumb, and it's going to be way more important than something in our brain. So it's really kind of just completely reversed.
But the real challenge is that compassion gap then, right? Kind of what I alluded to earlier, that if my experience of what I think mental illness is just, well, I felt sad once. we've all felt sadness, right? Mm-hmm. And so we might think, well, that's what people with mental illness are feeling. They're feeling sad. So they should do something like take a walk or, you know, that type of thing. And that's bringing our own experience onto someone else. Well, what we really need to do is walk in other people's shoes. We need to, you know, overcome that huge empathy and compassion gap that exists in society right now. But I don't think one person or even, you know, a group of people are going to do that. It's going to take all of us constantly sharing our stories. That you've exactly explained why I feel so passionate about advocating, about why Eric and I both share our stories, because we want people to know we're just like anybody else.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. And you're really a great spokesperson. And I'm glad you're involved with NAMI as well, because it's an important organization. And people in Boise, that's one thing you can do to make a difference is donate to NAMI, go to their events. They have walks and fundraisers. And
we have a really fun event coming up in October. Stay tuned. It's going to be really fun.
Okay, well, stay tuned. And it's NAMI.org, so you have to go
NAMIBoise.org.
To NAMIBoise.org to go to their site to see what's coming up, participate, come out of the woodwork. If you're having issues, and speak out. That's kind of what this is about. So really appreciate being on my show. Now, next week, I've got your son Eric on, so he's agreed to be on the show. I'm really excited to have him on the show. It's about telling his own story. And so we hear it from himself, you know, what is his experience. You have your version of it, but he has his version of it. So I'm excited to have him on the show. I might bring my other son on who's also struggling maybe at the same time. Maybe they can have a little question and answer between themselves. Who knows? But it'll be a fun show. So I really appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. So this is Dr. Kent. We're going to end this segment. On the next segment, I have Ron on my show. He's a person who struggled with depression. He's going to talk about his experience
Dr.
and also
Kent,
his triumph.
To
my weekly
it, so
show every exactly Sunday at 9 in the morning. You can visit my website at treasurevalleytms.com. On there, you can also post questions if you want or share your experiences. I'd love to bring your questions onto my show or even share your experiences. I'm all about kind of bringing local people into the show, talking about what they've gone through, making it relatable to people out there. I just had on my show Liza Long. She's an author. She went viral on the internet and then nationally with some of the blogs she's written about her son. So she's been on my show today. Next, I have Ron on my show. We're going to talk with him. He's suffered from depression, and we'll talk about that a little bit and his experience with that and what he's done to treat it. So welcome to my show, Ron.
It's cool. It's good to be here. My name is my name is Ron Martin, and I've suffered from depression for about 60 years, and I've suffered from OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, for about 60 years.
Wow. So how old are you now, Ron?
I'm 72.
72 years young.
Yes.
So I want to start out by kind of talking about sort of your experience with depression. And we won't talk so much about the OCD, but that is it's good to know that's also an issue as well. We'll talk a little bit about it. But let's talk about the depression you've had, sort of what symptoms you had of that or what it was like for you to be depressed. Talk a little bit about that.
The main symptom that I have when I'm depressed is what I call the sinking feeling. I have a feeling in my heart and upper abdomen that is like an emptiness. And it's very difficult for me to get rid of it. The one thing that has gotten rid of it is TMS.
And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. First of all, I want to just talk about your experience with depression. It sounds like that's the main feeling that you notice when you're depressed. Anything else you notice with your depression?
Well, I withdraw and sleep and read. I like to read.
So to pass the time, you read because you don't feel like doing anything else.
Watch TV. Yeah.
So you become pretty inactive.
Right.
Okay. How has that affected you? Because you're an attorney, so did that negatively impact your work?
Oh, terribly. I had to work especially the OCD, but the depression too. I had to work 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, to get the work done that some other attorneys were doing in 5 days a week, 8 hours a day.
So that tells me you had a lot of determination, even though you were struggling with a very serious illness.
Yes. Yes, I did.
That you weren't willing to quit.
And I was eighth in a class of 207 in law school. So it wasn't that I was dumber than the other attorneys. It was just that I had to struggle more.
So did you suffer in silence a lot of the time, that people didn't know that you had this depression?
No, my wife knew. We've been married for 47 years.
Congratulations on
that.
Thank
you.
That's
awesome.
Thank you,
yeah.
Most depressions will destroy a marriage.
Yes.
It's not usual that they can survive.
She stuck by me and has stuck by me and, has just been wonderful.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And I have two kids, both of whom are free of depression and OCD.
Did they ever have it?
They never had
it.
So
they never got that curse.
Never got that curse, is right. And one works for Apple and one works for Cisco. And the one who works for Cisco is here in Boise, and that's why we moved to Boise.
Now, didn't you come from Florida? Is that where you came from?
That's right, Boca Raton,
is that where you
Florida.
Practiced law?
Yes.
And now retired?
Retired, and don't know anything about Idaho law. So I can't answer any questions.
Okay. That's okay. I'm not really concerned about that either right now. I'm assuming with the depression there was times when you felt pretty hopeless.
Hopeless and helpless. It was really terrible.
When people feel hopeless, sometimes they feel like life isn't worth living anymore.
Yes.
Did that ever cross your mind?
I did attempt suicide one time when I was in my early 30s. And I took a bottle of pills, and they were able to revive me. And thankfully, I've stuck around for almost 40 more years.
That's impressive. Well, if they had to revive you, that sounded like a pretty serious attempt.
Yes, it was.
And statistically, if people live with depression long enough, they're going to attempt suicide most likely, because it just becomes so difficult to live with. So that's just more common than it's not. In Idaho, one person dies every day of completed suicide in Idaho.
Really?
So I like to bring light to that, because we have a serious problem right here in our own state, right here locally, that we need to address. So in the past, you've been treated for your depression. What sort of treatments did you receive before?
Well, the first treatment I received was to go to a clinical psychologist, who, I don't know if he was afraid that he would lose me as a patient if he recommended me to a psychiatrist, but I never even knew, and this was when I was young, I never even knew that there was medication. And then I got depressed while I was an attorney in Cleveland, and was put in a mental hospital. And for the first time, I received medication. The medication helped somewhat, but not tremendously. I've been in a mental hospital three or four times since.
So you've tried multiple medications along the way.
Yes, all along the way. The one I'm on now is an anaphronil, or clomipramine.
That's also used to treat obsessive-compulsive
disorder.
That's
right. That's right. And that has helped the obsessive-compulsive disorder, but it hasn't done much for the depression.
So how did you discover this TMS?
Well, I had TMS. I read about TMS when I was in Florida, and I had TMS in Florida, and it worked for me. And just to reference something that you talked about, I have also had ECT. The ECT worked, but not well. It was a real struggle to get the ECT. They would give me anesthesia, and my body would be paralyzed, and I'd be awake. I wouldn't be able to breathe.
Yeah, that's a frustrating position to be in when that happens.
Yes.
So with the TMS, what would you say about that?
The TMS is the only thing that has worked for me.
So how do you feel now that you've been treated with, I use a form of TMS called deep TMS, but how have you been feeling since you've been treated?
I went, just to give you a test result, to give the listeners a test result, I scored 14 on the depression scale when I first started, and when I ended, I was a 3.
That's a pretty big improvement.
It surely is.
Yeah, I saw you really start to smile as you went through the treatment, and I could see that it was working, and you're very jovial, and that was coming out, and easy to talk with. So it's always impressive to see somebody with 60 years of depression who's had to receive the highest level of treatment, including ECT, respond to TMS, which is a non-invasive treatment for depression.
TMS has been a miracle to me.
And that's just exciting for me, too, and that's what gives me pleasure, is to see someone like this and feel your joy and see how you're doing better. And, you know, you're at the end of your life where you want to enjoy things and you don't have to work and you have family and you're here to enjoy family and you want to enjoy them and not be sad or depressed or hopeless or not enjoying anything.
Right.
So it's really important at this point in time to make that happen. So I'm excited for you. So I'd assume you would recommend this to somebody else.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to say that you and your assistant, Kim, have really gone the extra mile for me. And it's made a big difference in my response.
Well, we hope so. You know, it really is about taking care of people and making sure they get better. And it's always what it's been about for me. It's taken somebody who's been hopeless and struggling for years and years and years and seeing a turnaround.
Right.
And that doesn't always happen, but when it does happen, it's really gratifying from my standpoint and satisfying for my staff who see it. And they're new to the TMS world, so they're now pretty big advocates. Now that they've seen enough people come through the treatment cycle and see how many people are responding who didn't look so good before. So I've got to end my show today.
Okay.
I appreciate you being on the show, Ron.
Pleasure.
And join us next week at 9 a.m. on Sunday mornings. We'll hear every week, and we're bringing people onto the show. So thank you for listening in today.